This is the fifth day of this April 2017 seven-day session. And we'll take one more day on our text, Mud and Water, which is a collection of talks by the Japanese Zen master Basui. It's translated by Arthur Braverman. He starts by quoting Zen master Rinzai, or Linji, to give his actual Chinese name. But since he's Japanese, he uses the Japanized name, Rinzai, so I'll do the same. The master Rinzai said, "I do not hold on to the worldly or the sacred without, nor do I dwell on the substance within. I see penetratingly and harbor no mistaken doubt." And then Basui says, "Just look sharply during the four activities, walking, standing, sitting, and lying down, in response to relationships and conditions. Hitting upon each opportunity, kill the mind that functions in that moment as you would an enemy met on a narrow road. Be like one who not only tries to smother a fire, but immediately pours water on the warm ash. If even a fine hair were left unslain, you would be cast away in the world of life and death. Turning inward, turning outward, destroying everything completely, you will for the first time begin to achieve the proper results." So, to decode this, kill the mind that functions in that moment. That is, by withdrawing, nourish the nourishment of attention. Our thoughts are nourished through our attention to them. And we deprive them of life, this thought mind, by turning our attention to the practice that is beyond thought. Kill the mind that functions in that moment. But do it thoroughly, he says. Not only smothering a fire, but pouring water on the warm ash. If even a fine hair were left unslain, you would be cast away in the world of life and death. There's a koan in the Blue Cliff record where the master says, when a single particle of dust arises, the world, with but a single particle of dust, the world arises. With no dust, the world perishes. The world of thought. Just look sharply during the four activities in response to relationships and conditions. Look. Look at the mind. Notice what's going on moment by moment. In all circumstances and conditions. Realize that all form is apparition and stop calculating. Realize that all views are delusion and kill the Buddha when he appears in your mind and the patriarchs when they appear in your mind and ordinary people when they appear in your mind. Destroy the world when it appears, and the void when it appears. In other words, getting beyond both the world of phenomena and the world of emptiness. Stop calculating. Some people can waste so much time during Sesshin calculating in terms of time and in other ways. At this time, though you may understand all the worlds in the 10 directions to be simply the one diamond essence, you will still fall into the trap of attachment to Dharma. Those who go beyond the ranks of ordinary people, to the contrary, fall into the trap of considering themselves sages. Though you cut off thoughts of both ordinary people and sages, though you do not stop before the cold, withered tree, though you cross the bright, moonlit river and pass through the land of darkness, if you think you have realized the mysterious functioning of the extraordinary, you still may not have let go of attachment to your ability. So no matter what experiences we have, what insights have to, we're always at risk of getting attached to those insights, those so-called attainments. Forgetting the true flavor of the Buddhas and patriarchs and not realizing the universal essence, you sojourn in the cold ashes of the long smothered fire, having yet to become intimate with the teachings. Being caught in the cold ashes of the long smothered fire, meaning having no passion for the way. It's another risk, maybe especially so, the longer we've practiced, there is the danger of sinking into a kind of a routine practice and safe practice. Safe and uneventful practice. Just plodding along, staying between the lines. Steady as she goes. If we're doing really vital zazen, good qualities zazen, that we will be our practice will be renewed over and over again, endlessly, revitalized. If that's not happening, then we have to find a way to get more thoroughly into this practice. Boredom is another trap that we can remedy through a more committed way of practicing, more intense way of practicing. Boredom is always a sign that we're not deep enough. We're still relatively on the surface. These other allusions here, even though you do not stop before the cold, withered tree, the withered tree stands for the quiet, empty mind, though you cross the bright, moonlit river and pass through the land of darkness, the moonlit, the bright, moonlit river and the land of darkness is that we're told by the footnote here, it's a land of the world of relativity, light and dark. So he's reminding every single one of his monks, every single reader, that it doesn't matter how far we've gone, what we've realized, we can't stop, we can't become complacent. Still further to go, more to realize. I've found through personal experience that each turning point in practice, insight, we can feel that, okay, this is it. This is the crowning achievement. And then if we press on, we find that it wasn't after all. So easy to deceive ourselves in this practice. We're so ready to rest in what we've come to understand. This encouragement he has is to kill the Buddha, kill the patriarchs, kill ordinary people when they appear in your mind. Is any thought of oneself or others as enlightened or unenlightened? Kill them all. He continues, "Do you wish to penetrate directly and be free? When I am talking like this, many people are listening. Quickly, look at the one who is listening to this talk. Who is she who is listening right now?" If you were to conclude that it is the mind, nature, Buddha, the way, if you were to call it the principle, the matter, the non-transmitted teaching of the Buddhas and patriarchs, the wonderful miracle, the occult, the mysterious, form, emptiness, if you were to understand it to be existence and nothingness, non-existence, non-nothingness, the absence of non-existence, or the absence of non-nothingness. He's addressing the philosophers in the crowd. If you were to conclude that it is eons of emptiness before creation, or consider it the understanding of koans, no mind, or non-interference, you would still be mixed up ordinary people who haven't left the path of reason. In other words, anything we consider it, any designation, any category, can't be it. It's a thought. It's a limitation. Designations are limitations. But he doesn't stop at warning about concepts. If, moreover, you were to make a fist and raise a finger, clap your hands and remain silent, launch into an explanation according to your understanding, or present the main point as you see it, you would be nothing more than a fellow trifling with spirits, a ghost clinging to the bushes and weeds. When nothing you try applies, what is it that does, after all, listen to the Dharma? If you can't answer, you get 30 blows. If you do answer, you still get 30 blows. How can you manage to avoid suffering these blows? Well, This reference to a ghost clinging to the bushes and weeds reminded me of that paragraph in Yasutani Roshi's commentary on Mu in the Three Pillars of Zen. So I pulled that out. It's arguably most important of all Zen books in English. And turn to the commentary on Mu, and here's Yasutani Roshi. If you cannot pass through the barrier and exhaust the arising of thoughts, you are like a ghost clinging to the trees and grass. This is Yasutani Roshi quoting Mumon's commentary to the Koan Mu. That was Mumon. And then Yasutani comments, "Ghosts do not appear openly in the daytime, but come out furtively after dark, it is said, hugging the earth or clinging to willow trees. They are dependent upon these supports for their very existence. In a sense, human beings are also ghost-like, since most of us cannot function independent of money, social standing, honor, companionship, authority. Or else we feel the need to identify ourselves with an organization or an ideology. If you would be one of true worth and not a phantom, you must be able to walk upright by yourself, dependent on nothing. When you harbor philosophical concepts or religious beliefs or ideas or theories of one kind or another, you too are a phantom, for inevitably you become bound to them. Only when your mind is empty of such abstractions are you truly free and independent." This is our mission in Zen practice, to become free of abstractions, concepts that we so habitually default to in our ordinary round of thought. And abstractions, this doesn't mean just philosophical concepts. It's really any thought is an abstraction, because it's not the direct experience. It's removed. It's once removed from the experience. It points to the experience, these words and concepts. The finger. Every thought is the finger pointing to the moon, at best, the moon, truth. And then a questioner steps forward. "The conscious mind is indeed like a dreaded enemy." Again, here, the conscious mind, meaning the discriminating mind, the mind that deceives us, the mind that creates abstractions. "The conscious mind is indeed like a dreaded enemy. What about when I look into my Buddha nature? How shall I consider it?" Come on, just look into your Buddha nature. But Basui says, "It too is like a dreaded enemy because it destroys your body and ends your life." Questioner, what do you mean? Basui, "The mud cow impetuously enters the water against the current. The wooden figure plays with raging flames in its bosom pocket." Let's go through that again. How is it that looking into our true nature destroys your body and ends your life? It's like a mud cow entering the water against the current. What's going to happen to that cow? The wooden figure playing with raging flames. This is why it takes so much courage to press on beyond ourselves, beyond everything. Gate, paragate, going beyond, far beyond, because we are approaching our disappearance. Disappearance of this notion of a self, this self-image we have, this ego that we've been carrying around our whole lives. We risk seeing that dissolve. From Japan, we have the story of the salt doll, where it's given voice and sentience. This salt doll never had seen the sea before, and so it comes over the sand dune and sees the sea there, and approaches it with great wariness, even some fear, and it ventures into the very shallows of the surf, and steps in, and the foot disappears, and it scampers back, and then ventures in a little further, and loses a little more, and now it's really hesitating, afraid to go any further. And then the sea says, what are you afraid of? The salt doll says, I have to say, I am afraid, but I so long to be there. And the sea encourages the salt doll to proceed further. And with faith, the doll does just that. It goes in deeper and deeper, and just as it's about to be engulfed with a final wave in the surf, the salt doll says, now I understand, the sea is me. We have absolutely nothing to fear in losing anything that is not essential to our nature. We can't lose by losing. It's a no-lose situation by losing, by seeing these accretions that we have built up about ourselves and others, by seeing these give way. Every step further into this realm of no mind is a step into freedom, greater freedom. But we have to confirm this for ourselves. There is almost always the hesitancy, the fear of disappearing. But if we keep venturing little by little further in to this realm of no mind, the mu, or the question, or the breath, then we discover with each step that we only gain by losing. Questioner, Master, you said earlier that the true teaching of the Buddhas and patriarchs is nothing other than pointing directly to people's minds and showing them that seeing into their own nature is Buddhahood. Now you talk neither of mind nor of nature. You just say we should look at that which listens to the Dharma. What does this mean? Basui, this is the true key to seeing into your own nature directly. Questioner, is this phrase, that which hears the Dharma, an expedient means created by you, Master, or is it from the sayings of the Buddhas and patriarchs? Basui, it is neither my expedient means, nor is it from the sayings of the Buddhas and patriarchs. It is the innate perfection of all people, the exquisite gate of emancipation of the Buddhas and patriarchs. In other words, it's nothing we need to acquire from Basui or from the Buddhas and patriarchs. It's our nature to look into our nature. here we're doing what is most natural to us in the deepest sense, what calls to us most profoundly, is just looking into our nature, into the mind. We're finally doing what we may have spent lifetimes, like hundreds, thousands of lifetimes approaching, which is to turn the mind around and look and see our very nature. For lifetimes we've been caught in objects, things. Now we have the chance to turn around and see the seer. Who is that? What is it? Questioner, all teachers everywhere give medicine in accord with the illness. You, Master, give this one medicine to everybody. Wouldn't this cause people to descend into a cave, a cave of attachment to this one medicine of looking into one's own nature? Vasui, there are an infinite variety of medicines that can be given in response to illnesses. The poisons which kill people do not discriminate between those of slight and considerable ability. If one actually consumes this poison and loses his life, who will have descended into a cave? Again, in Zen terms, this poison is our liberation. This losing our life is losing our life of separation, our life of delusion, of anxiety, of fear and frustration. Questioner, when we listen to all kinds of sounds, we are supposed to look penetratingly into the one who is listening. What if there isn't even one sound? Vasui, who is it that doesn't hear? Questioner, I have no doubt as to the one who is listening to the Dharma. Vasui, what is your understanding? The monk was silent. It's always a safe try, is to just be silent. Those who know do not speak. Those who speak do not know. Vasui spoke reprovingly. Don't spend your life sitting in a ghost cave. Questioner, neither the Buddhas nor the patriarchs can understand the one who listens to the Dharma. So sometimes we can imagine this as the same questioner coming back again and again but probably in most cases, these are different questioners, all stepping forward and taking a shot at Vasui. So this one says, neither the Buddhas nor the patriarchs can understand the one who listens to the Dharma. Vasui says, put the Buddhas and patriarchs aside for a moment. What about you? The monk responded, I too do not understand. So that puts him in his mind with the Buddhas and patriarchs. Vasui, what is the reason behind the Buddhas and patriarchs' lack of understanding? So he's pressing him there. He says, the Buddhas and patriarchs don't understand, and nor do I understand. What is the reason behind it? Vasui asks. The monk said nothing. Another monk said, this one who listens to the Dharma is clearly before your eyes. Vasui also rejects this. Don't get caught by Rinzai's three non-comprehensions. Speak. What is it that hears the Dharma right before your eyes? He too said nothing. Questioner, some good teachers nowadays just tell us to look into our own nature. Others tell us to look into the koan. Which one is better? Vasui, Originally, these meaningful expressions were all the same. Since 1,000 or 10,000 phrases simply become the one phrase of one's own nature is the foundation of the koan. Reach the roots, and there is no lamenting the branches. That's why, if beginning practitioners were at first looked directly into their own nature, they would be able to pass all koans naturally. You should know, however, that even though you clearly understand your own mind, if you can't penetrate the koans of the ancients, you still haven't realized enlightenment. That's why an ancient said, before one reaches attainment, it is more important for him to contemplate the meaning than the phrases. After one reaches attainment, it is more important for him to study the phrases than the meaning. So, to just add to what Basu is saying, the koan is a way to enable us to look into this self nature of ours. It's a method. For the first 500 years of Zen, or actually Chan in China, for those first 500 years, there were no koans. And then the koans were devised as a means to help us focus the mind and see beyond words and concepts. That's what every koan is doing. It's a way to train us to see through, develop X-ray vision to see through the deceptions of words and concepts into the reality that is behind them, to see beyond the finger to the moon itself. It's like we're like the dog or the baby that when you point to the moon looks at the finger. We want to swing our attention to the reality. It can be so difficult to do that because the mind, through long habit, the mind is always ready to conceptualize anything at all. Let's say even the word mu. If we're looking at purely at the word mu, we're seeing beyond the word mu into the reality of what it stands for, our own nature. But until then, that's a very advanced state, is seeing it purely. Until then, we just reflexively throw this film of conceptualizing around the word. As we do throw a film of conceptualizing around people and ideas and trees and everything, all phenomena where just through habit we tend to conceptualize it. We don't know it. We don't see it. It's so transparent, these membranes of conceptualization. But through long practice, we come to see how we remove ourselves, separate ourselves from the thing itself, the living, breathing thing, with our habit of conceptualizing, of living in our ideas instead of the thing itself. And of course, we do it to ourselves. We don't escape this. Our self-image itself is a concept. Because there's nobody there. We're working from memories and associations and habitual responses to the way other people have responded to us in our lives. And as a result, we build up this aggregate of a self that is just so many thoughts and concepts. He quotes Hyakujo, the great Chinese master, "All words and sayings gently turn, returning to the self. If you truly perfect enlightenment, realizing in this manner, not only will the rare words and wonderful phrases of the Buddhas and ancestors become the self, but there will be nothing in all creation that is not the self." Questioner: "Then in other words, if I desire to clarify my own mind, I have to look at all creation?" Basui: "No, you don't. The desire to clarify your own mind is for the sake of understanding the great matter of life and death. When your aspiring heart is ripe for this, seeing forms as they are and clarifying the mind, you will realize the way through your contact with things. But if from the beginning you want to clarify the self, looking at all creation, you will lose your criterion for measurement and without fail enter the path of heretics." That is the danger of looking outside oneself. "If you desire to clarify your own mind, look penetratingly into the origin of the one who hears all sounds right now. Where the thinking path is exhausted and the roots of life cease, there the self becomes tranquil and the time of life's fulfillment arrives. An ancient said, when you return to the origin, you obtain the essence. When you follow the external light, you lose sight of the teachings." Again, the external light, looking at objects, rather than turning the mind back to the source, our own consciousness, our own mind. And then he quotes Zen Master Mumon again, "To practice Zen, you must pass through the gate of the patriarchs. To attain this uncommon realization, it is necessary to exhaust the way of thinking completely. If you do not pass through the gate of the patriarchs and do not exhaust the way of thinking, whatever you do will be like a ghost clinging to weeds and bushes." So that's the very illusion that that Yasutani Roshi was commenting on in the Three Pillars. To exhaust the way of thinking completely. We discover how much work it takes to really exhaust this thinking mind. We're well on our way to doing that. Everyone is. Sitting day and night for, 5 days now? 5.5 days? We're well on our way to exhausting this thinking mind. It's still putting up a fight. It's still coming back. But through this persistent, dogged, returning our mind, turning our attention back to the practice, gradually we're dissolving more and more of these thoughts that are so stubborn in the mind. We just have to not lose heart, but press on. Every time we catch ourselves lost in thought, just drop it. Get back to the practice we're working on. Trust the practice. Trust it. It's all we need to exhaust this mind, is to continually, indefatigably return to this one practice we're working on. And it will do the process of exhausting the mind. This seems like a good place to stop, so let's stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.